Thank you very much. President Bertinotti, Professor Emanuel, Mr. Chairman, friends.
Microphone.
Well, it's working on. How's that? Okay. As I am sure you know, my country, the United States, has just passed through an interesting political drama, with parts of the government closed down and questions raised about the ability or willingness to pay the most basic obligations, including interest on the national debt. That immediate political crisis has been resolved, but what remains is an underlying policy consensus that has been, if anything, made stronger by these developments. And that is the idea that as a central imperative of economic policy, public expenditure must be cut, and either the cuts will come immediately in some of the core administrative and regulatory functions of government, or they will be made to come later, in which case they will affect most seriously the core social insurance programs, which are in the U.S. Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. I raise this as an example of a general ideological condition. I don't think I need to tell you that the same essential idea is dominant everywhere in Europe, and that this is the product of what, in his paper for this conference, President Bertinotti has described very fully as the ascendancy of la pensée unique. My remarks today are going to focus on this, above all, on this state of ideas, how it endures 5 years after the most fundamental financial and economic crisis of living memory, and what we might do now in order to create a different climate of ideas going forward. The first point I think I would make in this connection is that the situation that we observe, I think it's uncontroversial, in the presence of governments that might once have been described as moderately left-wing in the United States, in France, here in Italy, this represents a complete ideological and political defeat for those who confronted the crisis 5 years ago with the revival of the ideas of John Maynard Keynes. A Keynesian revival of which I was at least in some respect a part, but which was led by prominent economists, including in the United States, Paul Davidson, wrote a book called The Keynes Solution. Lord Robert Skidelsky in the UK, his book was The Return of the Master, And of course, my friend Paul Krugman, who followed shortly with a book that was called End This Depression Now. One can argue about whether this defeat was because the policies were tried and failed, or whether they were never adequately tried at all. But that argument is secondary to the fact. And the fact is that the simple, what we will call Keynesian position, has no traction at the moment, and very few prospects for recovering the initiative, either intellectually or politically. I'm not going to try to justify that state of affairs. It may be unjust, but it is the state of affairs. And there are, I think, three consequences of this fact. The first is that the opposing position of politics of unremitting austerity remains in firm control. Especially in Europe, where it is accompanied by quite preposterous claims that austerity will lead to confidence, competitiveness, and growth. And in the US, where the rhetoric is a little different, but the effect is the same, we speak of responsibility and balance. It's obvious we don't have a problem of confidence in the public debt. A second implication is that if we wish to make a renewed assault on this preposterous consensus, we need to understand why the previous assault didn't work. And beyond that, we need to propose something which is richer and deeper and more persuasive. I would not describe the dominance of the austerity position as an intellectual triumph of right-wing economic thought, of the Chicago School or the Mont Pelerin Society, even though there was such a triumph. That triumph occurred a generation ago. Today, one can, of course, find adherents of this position who have PhDs in economics in the supporting staff of the austerity movement. But no one will mistake them for great figures. No one will confuse, let's say, Rogoff and Reinhardt, or with all due respect, Alessinia and Ardania, or the latter-day Eugene Fama, with, let's say, Milton Friedman, Robert Lucas, or Friedrich von Hayek. The present generation lacks weight. They fall on the wrong side of the distinction between creating theory and inventing quotations. I may be a little bit unfair here to, let's say, someone like Fama, who at one point started out building up on the foundations that Milton Friedman and Robert Lucas had created. But the fact is, that worldview that gave us serious engagement with something as strange as the efficient markets hypothesis crumbled a long time ago. And so the house with which the current generation is preoccupied in decorating lost its foundation. And the economics profession knows this. The fact that the Nobel Committee of the Zürcher Riksbank just gave its prize to Robert Shiller and Professor Fama simultaneously, is a sign of the uncertainty and confusion in that camp. As my friend Yanis Varoufakis said, this was exactly as though they had given it to, at the same time, to Galileo and to the Inquisition. What we have is not an austerity economics of substance, but rather one of slogans. The claim, again, that austerity produces confidence and growth, that public debt is in and of itself and under all conditions a problem, an impediment to economic activity, and the claim, furthermore, that economies will recover from this crisis automatically and rapidly, except and only insofar as they are not blocked by government intervention. All of this is just, as I say, sloganeering. So why didn't the Keynesian revival prevail against so deeply damaged and weakened an intellectual opponent? My view is that it overplayed its hand, offered a set of solutions that were framed in terms that were far too simple, and so foreclosed the possibility that it would become a persuasive body of ideas. And there were a kind of historical confusion associated with this, insofar as the Keynesians, the new Keynesians, invoked Keynes by asserting a parallel between the present and the conditions of the 1930s, but at the same time accepted the Keynesian model and the description of conditions that really did not emerge until the 1960s in the United States and Europe, and that was designed to address what was conceptually a very different situation. One in which there was an expectation of a continuing trend, world without end, of economic growth, deviations from which were just recessions, departures of output from potential, and departures of employment from what Milton Friedman came to call the natural rate. And these two things became, in the passage of time, deeply confused in people's minds, and you don't have to be a right-winger to see that there's a problem here. So let me make an effort bringing in a discussion of the facts of our situation to try and sort this out and to begin to work toward a, let's call it, a realistic economics for the present condition. I want to do this first by offering two historical generalizations that might clarify the comparison between conditions today and the conditions of the 1930s. First of them has to do with finance, and the second one has to do with resources. What we saw in the 1930s, beginning in the United States in 1929 with the stock market crash, run on the banks, and with the failure of the Kreditanstalt in 1930, was a collapse of the previous structure of finance capitalism. It was a thorough collapse, and it was thoroughly recognized as such. And the result was the proliferation of alternative models. for national survival and economic recovery. And this is a history. It's a history which is, I guess, recorded on that wall in the next room in part. Soviet communism, national socialism, fascism, the New Deal in the United States. In each case, these alternative models went very far toward replacing the financial sector as the driving force behind the expansion of economic activity. So it's very different from the post-war view of Keynesianism as pump priming. There were, in the 1930s, no pump priming solutions because all of the pumps were broken. Straightforward. And everyone knew it. And in the aftermath of the Second World War, while private finance did come back, it came back in a structured framework where many of the institutions remained public and the rules were entirely set by the public sector, and that continued into the 1970s. In terms of resources, the 30s were also a very interesting and important time because they were the crucial decade in the transition from coal to oil, which transformed both economic activity, transformed technology, transformed the military position in various countries in the world. The fact that the United States and the USSR had their own oil reserves was a very important economic and military fact. The fact that Britain and France had empires that gave them at least potential access to oil was also a very important fact. The British Navy was built on that fact, the British Admiralty. And as for Germany and Japan, the fact that they did not have immediate access to that resource was an important motive force behind the aggressive war that those two countries waged. Right? Japan, in the case, moved toward Malaya and Indonesia, and Germany toward the Caucasus. In the post-war period, all of these issues, which were very clear in the 1930s, began to just faded away. Finance, as I say, was eventually reconstructed. Some of its dangers were forgotten. And a great superabundance of energy resources enabled the West to proceed on the basis of the idea that resources no longer factored in economic calculations. And on this basis, the whole world lived quite happily for the first 25 years after the war, ran into difficulties in the 1970s, and half the world, particularly the United States, but the rich countries generally, continued to live happily for another 25 years from, let's say, 1982 to 2007. While the other half, much of the commodity-producing world and obviously the Soviet lands and Eastern Europe, suffered rather wrenching transitions from the fact that they were faced with high debt loads and low commodity prices. So having stated these facts, I think it's possible to make a more coherent comparison between the Great Depression and our own time. In both situations, finance has collapsed, but this time around, instead of rebuilding on alternative models, we have simply propped the existing institutions up. We have maintained them in existence. We continue to pay their salaries and to cover the enormous fixed cost that finance has come to impose on the larger economy. The United States, 30% of profits, 10% of all wages, an enormous sector for something that produces nothing that's consumed in the final basket of consumption goods. Also, obviously, creates a situation in Europe and the United States in which finance and government are intimately intertwined, and we, as well as I suppose you, do not see officials entrusted with financial policy who are not rooted in financial institutions, and very particular ones at that. So that's a big difference. And it's a difference for which there may be no clear long-term solution. That is to say, credible alternative models, or for that matter, the technical capability to bring these large institutions back under a degree of discipline, control, and public purpose. It's possible that someone will figure out how to do this. I haven't certainly figured it out yet. It seems to me to be a very, very challenging problem. And the second big difference is that, to most appearances, the worldwide resource constraint has returned. Resource constraint that was very apparent to the economists of the 19th century and up through, let's say, Keynes's economic consequences of the peace in 1919, but as I said, disappeared in the 1950s and for a long time afterwards. One qualification concerns, particularly interesting in the United States right now, the prospects of natural gas extracted from shale. And I'm following that situation closely. This is clearly a major new development. How long lasting it will be is frankly unknown. It's unknown to the people in the business. And that uncertainty rests with us all and will continue to do so, because this is a new technology which cannot be modeled. It simply has to be played out in real time. But there is, even beyond that, of course, as we all are aware, a binding constraint which will come to affect us sooner or later, which is climate change. So the energy situation is far more complex and challenging than it was in the 1930s. In addition to that, there is an obvious fact that the use of military force to relieve resource constraints by any country, including the United States, is now, practically speaking, a thing of the past, a dead letter. And that's recognized by the professionals involved. We've come out of Iraq, having accomplished exactly what, I'm not sure. And we're coming out of Afghanistan, having accomplished, so far as everybody knows, even less. And that's a professional assessment, not a political or an ideological one. So one has to ask, under what conditions will anybody try to use military force for this kind of question ever again? My supposition is that it will be a very long time, perhaps ever, before this is seriously argued for. Fourth point has to do with another aspect of these changes, which is the technological aspect. The big technology that emerged in the age of oil was the internal combustion engine and the turbojet and so forth later. These things destroyed jobs in certain capacities, but they created a lot of jobs as well. An enormous number of jobs in production and maintenance and in the associated infrastructure. We are now in the middle of a technological revolution with very different properties. These things have very little of the same job-creating properties. They create activity. They reduce the cost of communication, entertainment. But in terms of jobs, they're very few, and the income flows are very concentrated. There is a parallel with the oil age. What the digital technologies are doing is very comparable to what the internal combustion engine did to the horse. Left a lot of them unemployed. Horses, however, did not require retirement services. So we have at least these four important objective difficulties facing us. Breakdown of finance, the resource constraint, the end of the military age, and the particular direction of the digital technologies. What is the possible, what are the outlooks? I think there are basically two possibilities here, one of which I will not go into. That's the possibility that growth will end and be actually negative for the indefinite future. I can't go into that because that is a scenario under which private profit-seeking activity will collapse. If that's the outcome, we will shortly face much more radical questions than I'm prepared to face right now. And the other possibility is that we will still have some scope for positive growth, but less than before. In which case, one might say that this is the moment when the ideas of the Accademia Nazionale di Lincei in the 1970s come back into play in a serious way. So if that's the case, what does it imply for us thinking about policy? I will be very brief because I think the core message is really quite simple. There are, again, two possibilities. One is that you permit some players in the system, the dominant ones, and in our system, the financial leadership, to extract what are effectively predatory gains at everybody else's expense. That's one possibility. And I do not believe that can go on forever in any society. It's a formula for crises, for conflict, and for collapse. And the other possibility is that you replace the dogma of austerity with a framework of solidarity, of mutual support, of limited gains but protection against catastrophic losses. That's the other possibility. The two things are mathematically both possible, but the idea that everybody's going to have big gains is not compatible with an overall environment of much more difficult situation. And I would suggest that going forward, thinking about this problem, one must focus on the attack on social insurance, on social welfare, on the welfare state, on this core value that emerged in the 20th century of keeping the population's basic conditions of life stable. There is an enormous attack on it. It's a predatory attack. That's what the austerity movement is about. And that is also the point at which it is, in many ways, weakest. The second choice of maintaining social insurance, of maintaining decent retirement schemes, maintaining public health, public education, basic housing, is the democratic choice. It's what democracy means in an advanced society. It means that you put together a governing framework that serves the public at large. And you hope to have enough flexibility from the success of that to be able to address, in part, these technical challenges, engineering challenges that arise in the areas of energy and climate. There is obviously a very specific challenge in the European context, which I think bears mentioning, and I'll close on this point, in comparison with the United States. The difference is that the United States had the New Deal as a national and therefore continental matter. And the New Deal meant that although the United States social insurance framework is weak, it covers the whole country. Having committed itself to a European Union, the core defect, fatal flaw, maybe intendedly fatal flaw in the neoliberal vision, was to reserve social insurance to the national level. And that is in a condition of constraint, is forcing basically a politics of national triage on Europe. where some countries are protected and others are allowed to fail. However, if one fails, others will quickly fail afterwards. That's the nature of financial markets. If Greece is allowed to collapse, and it is in the process of collapsing as we speak, the attack will fall on Portugal, on Ireland, on Spain, and ultimately here on Italy. One can be quite sure of that. I say this in broad historical context, that an economic union does not survive the departure of even its smallest entities. The Soviet Union did not survive the departure of the Baltics, even though they wanted to go, and the other part didn't want to keep them. Yugoslavia did not survive the departure of Slovenia. To go back a little bit further in US history, the Federal Union of the United States in 1860 did not survive the departure of South Carolina, which was described at the time by one resident as too small for a republic and too large for an insane asylum. The choice in Europe is not a dichotomy between austerity and faith on the one side and some ponderous new federalism down the road on the other. It seems to me it has to be a forceful, this dichotomy has to be overcome by forceful demands for practical change. Above all, a change in ideas founded on a very clear, direct understanding of what the central issue actually is, avoiding simple answers to simple nonsense, and a realistic appraisal of where we actually stand, of all the physical, technical, and institutional limits and challenges. But if we build an economics and a body of thought on that foundation, then it seems to me that we stand a reasonable chance of carrying the case, of being broadly persuasive. And that's what we should hope to do. Thank you very much.